Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, presented to you by the Combined Arms Doctrine Directorate at the Combined Arms Center at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. The views expressed here are those of the individual and do not represent the views of the Combined Arms Center, U.S. Army, or U.S. government.
Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, a U.S. Army Combined Arms Center podcast on emerging doctrine and the Army's vision of warfare. Hello, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Lisa Becker, host of today's Breaking Doctrine episode. I'm sitting down with Colonel Retired John Antle, a former armor officer, author of over a dozen books, public speaker, and changemaker. He is passionate about everyone understanding the changing methods of war. Join us today on the first of two episodes discussing the overlap between Mr. Antle's work and the imperatives found in FM30. Those imperatives are actions Army forces must take to defeat enemy forces and achieve objectives at acceptable cost. Today, we will focus on two imperatives: see yourself, see the enemy, and understand the operational environment. And we will wrap up the episode talking about the imperative, account for being under constant observation in all forms of enemy contact. Sir, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much for being on your show. I think this is going to be an interesting and informative opportunity for many people out there.
Sir, could you start off by talking about what you're working on, thinking about, talking to others about?
Right. Well, first of all,
I am on a quest to try to get Army leaders and our government leaders and our allied leaders to understand the changing methods of warfare. Now, I have done an in-depth study of the war since 2020, and there have been many major conflicts that we need to understand and study. And what I find across the force that not enough people are studying them, not enough people know about them, and we have lessons we have to learn. So if we can't learn from other people's fights, then we're going to have a problem in that we will pay the price for that in our own treasure and blood. So learning from, for instance, the Second Nagorno-Karabakh War, the first war in history that was primarily won by robotic systems. Wow, think about that. Why don't we know that? 44-day decisive victory by Azerbaijan over Armenia. And many people say that, well, that war doesn't rise to the level of our need to understand. And I strongly disagree with that hubris, with that idea. We need to understand what happened between these two peer competitors in 2020 and how Azerbaijan leveraged a small UAS and also unmanned combat aerial vehicles and all sorts of other loitering munitions and other weapon systems, precision weaponry, to win this decisive victory and tip the scales in their favor. When the enemy held the ground for 25 years and created in-depth defensive positions, and they held the mountains, and it didn't matter. So that's the kind of thing we need to study. And then we need to study the Israeli-Hamas war of 2021, and that war was only 11 days long, and most people don't even recognize that as a conflict. That 11-day fight was won primarily because the Israelis, for the first time in history, were able to leverage AI to the point where that war was won primarily by artificial intelligence. Wow, why don't we know that, and why don't we study that? You see, they were able to get closest to a kill web as ever has been achieved. And they were able to get fires and sensors to operate in real time to understand where the enemy was. And by the way, this had great effects because they tracked Hamas because of their cell phones. And from this, Hamas stopped using cell phones. And Hezbollah said, we got to learn from that. So they stopped using cell phones. And they went to pagers. No kidding. And you think you know about the pager incident that just recently happened. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Israelis set all this up from that fight. And then, of course, there's the ongoing Russo-Ukrainian war, which has lessons every day. And what it has proven to us more than anything else is that innovation is crucial. You have to be able to innovate on the run. And right now, we're not even running, and we need to be innovating, and we're not innovating as fast as we should. And it is something that we really need to pay attention to. And in addition to that, what it also shows is that drones, which consist of ISR drones, intelligence, surveillance, or reconnaissance drones, bomber drones that drop grenades and things,
first-person view drones, which are kamikaze drones, and loitering munitions and UCAVs, all of these things have become the machine gun of the 21st century. You wouldn't go to war today without a machine gun. But we right now in our units don't have drones integrated into our formations. Some people will say, yes, we do. We have the Black Hornet. We have others. We don't integrate drones the way we should. And the Israelis are giving us a great example of that in the next war we should be studying, which is since 2023, October 7th, the war that they've been fighting against Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran, and the Houthis. And that war has many lessons for us. So each one of those offers case studies that our leaders should be studying and teaching other leaders in our military. And I find that that's not happening to the depth and to the level it should be. And that really frightens me, because we need to be thinking and acting so we can gain foresight. And foresight is the ability to solve problems in the short term and create solutions for the long run. So if you go to an average formation, a striker brigade, a tank brigade, an infantry brigade, they have very few, if any, drone operators in their units. Very few drones are integrated into their formations. So we need to be working hard on a new thing called multi-domain combined arms operations. And what the point of that is, the major central point of that is the integration of drones into our tactical formations. So when you go down on your qualification range for a tank crew or a tank platoon or a tank company, and they're going down range, they should have small UAS, ISR small UAS, giving real-time feeds to that tank crew.
Mm-hmm.
We have bots before boots in every situation. We're still doing tank operations and infantry operations much like we have 30 years ago. And we need to think this through. We will not be the army we should be until we've integrated robots and robotic systems in such a way that we're getting real-time information to our fighters, and in fact, we're able to use that real-time information to kill them with drones farther over the horizon. And there's many other things that we need to do to change our combined arms operations to upgrade ourselves to be the best army in the world, not the army that fought the last war.
Now, I know you have some disruptors in today's battlefield. So in today's conversation, I'd like to compare those with imperatives above M3O. So could you give listeners a rundown of your disruptors so we can understand those as we talk through the imperatives too?
Yes, but happy to do so. In my deep study of the wars that have happened just since 2020, and of course, wars that have happened before then, what I see are there are now 10. I had 9 before, but I've added one. So now there are 10 disruptors that are changing warfare as we know it. Now, in 10 years, there may be different disruptors, but these 10 are transforming the wars that are happening right now. The first is the transparent battle space. What that means is that if the enemy tries hard enough, they can see everything in the battle space if they put the energy into it. Now, you can blind them, but until they're blinded, they have satellites that can see almost everything. They have aircraft, they have drones, and by the way, there's also the stratosphere. If you put balloons in the stratosphere, now who would do that? Balloons in the stratosphere, just imagine. You can put ISR platforms on those balloons, and you can see almost everything, and they're very difficult to shoot down, as we saw, you know, a few years ago. So our challenge right now is that everything can be seen. So when you look at what happened to the Ukrainians in 2023 during their counterattack in the Donbass, they in fact were seen way ahead of time by the Russians in everything they did. And they fought in the old way, and they died in the old way, and the counterattack failed. Now, there's a lot of reasons why it failed, but one of them reasons was this transparent battle space. The Russians could see, and once you see, you can then mass your fires on those forces that are seen. And because you can't hide in this battle space, it is very difficult to mask, and you need to embrace masking. And I'll talk about masking in a second. You need to embrace masking. And since we don't have that as part of our culture, the Ukrainians were seen, and they were badly hit, and they weren't able to penetrate the Russian lines. What's interesting is that August of 2024, the Ukrainians were able to mass in a transparent battle space by masking their forces in such a way that the Russians didn't know they were launching the counterattack into the Kursk Oblast. So what you have there are two different case studies. Follow the 2023 case study and then look at the 2024 case study and see how things changed. Now, the Ukrainians didn't tell us they were going to launch an invasion of Russia, which was probably a very smart move because they needed to keep it secret. And secondly, they massed their forces to a level that has not been seen on modern battle space, because our problem right now is you cannot mass forces in a transparent battle space that is dominated by precision fires. So that's the crucial problem of fighting right now. The next one is the first strike advantage. And the first strike advantage is one that truly keeps me up at night, because when you look at all of our forces across the world, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Romania, Poland, Germany, all of our forces in the Pacific, all of our forces in Korea, for instance, our forces live in peacetime barracks. Our motor pools are set up in peacetime configuration. Our logistics are all consolidated. And if you're the enemy and you have transparent battle space and precision weaponry, your first strike against any U.S. forces in Europe, in the Pacific, in the Middle East, these forces are a great risk. And therefore, they could take down 20, 30, 40, 50% of our forces in the first strike, because their ballistic missiles are ready to go. We do not have an iron dome over our forces. So imagine what would happen if the enemy hit us first without warning. And has that ever happened before? Of course.
Yep.
And in my book, The Next War, first chapter, I talk about how the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, if they had changed some things, could have been a decisive strike rather than just a great victory. It could have been a decisive strike to win the war. And that's what our enemies are looking for now. So the third one that I talk about is artificial intelligence and the tempo of war. Artificial intelligence is changing everything. Artificial intelligence is dramatically changing the world. You no longer use a paper map to navigate from point A to point B when you drive your car. You put on your phone and it talks to you. It gives you precise navigation directions. That speeds up your travel. You get lost a lot less. In the olden days, when you had a paper map, people would get lost and they'd have to get out and ask for directions. Doesn't happen very much now. That's an example of how AI is speeding up things, getting things done faster. Well, AI is speeding up the tempo of war dramatically. And when you see targets in real time in a transparent battle space, and you really have that information in real time to weapon systems that can see, that can destroy those targets, and then you coordinate that, that in fact speeds everything up so that strikes will happen, can happen, absolutely, with great rapidity in real time. So AI is crucial in changing everything, and it is changing everything across the board as far as sensing, as far as navigation, as far as command and control, all of those things. And AI will be critical for us in the future to use to understand all of these systems in order to act in time, because the tempo is so fast, we cannot act unaided anymore. The next is top attack. And top attack is where the enemy is now blowing us up from the top. Their precision-guided munitions, their missiles, their anti-tank-guided missiles, their drones all hit us from the top. We used to worry about the front of our armor and how thick it was. Then we worried about the bottom and tried to make a V-shaped L, all in all this. But now we're getting hit from the top. And if you look at what's going on in Ukraine, you will see that the Russians are taking horrific casualties. You know, 2,000-3,000 casualties a month. You know, correction, a day, with almost 40,000 to 50,000 casualties last month. And a lot of those dead because of this top attack capability. And the way we've been used, the Ukrainians and others use drones. The next is fully autonomous. As there's a battle of action, counteraction, and reaction, electronic warfare is being used more and more to jam the Wi-Fi signals from drones. The simple hobby drones that most people were using last year in the Ukrainian war were very jammable. But these are now being changed
and they're being added to with different types of systems, including artificial intelligence inside the drone, other systems like for instance, fiber optic cable, somewhat not fiber optic cable, but basically cables being fired from the back of the drone, so that the operator can operate and can't be jammed. So it's operated just like a tow missile, you know, was where you didn't have, where you had a wire coming out the back, and also a computer vision. So more and more of drones will have computer vision with waypoints in them, where they'll go from point A to point B to point C, and then they'll go on with the target, and the operator will be able to then either take control of the drone or the drone will attack on its own. So as more and more systems become fully autonomous, the timing to be able to counter them decreases, is much, much shorter, and we have to be able to think that through. The next is what I call the super swarm. I just recently saw a video about the largest drone formation for a light show in China, where one computer controlled over 6,000 drones. That's pretty incredible. And if you imagine that kind of thing being militarized, where one person commands 6,000 attack drones, that is a super swarm. Right now we have a strange situation where drones have to be operated one human, one drone. And also, they can't have too many frequencies, because if they have a bunch of frequencies on, you know, the same frequency, they jam each other. But a super swarm is totally different. And the Chinese and we are working on how to do super swarms. They're ahead of us, just by what you can see in the commercial market. And when they develop a super swarm for military purposes, we will have a huge challenge. Could a super swarm be countered? Yes. Are we ready to counter it? No. So we've got to think that through. The next is the kill web. And I mentioned the kill web was used in the Hamas-Israeli war of 2021, where the Israelis brought Hamas to their knees in 11 days. Because what happened with the kill web was that they were able to, if you could imagine an Excel spreadsheet, where you had all of the targets that are seen in one column by the sensors from all the different, all multi-domain sensors. And then the next column is all of the weapon systems that can destroy those targets that are in range. And the next is execution. That's basically what the Israelis were able to do. The targets and the shooters were linked in real time. And then they were able to execute that in real time. And it was so overwhelming that Hamas begged for a ceasefire. Now, Hamas learned from that and came back and hit Israel in October 2023, October 7th, with a very low tech attack that was very successful that the Israeli sensors didn't see. So we have to think this through, but the kill web that the Israelis were able to use is a lesson for us, because if that kill web is used by the Chinese or the Russians in a first strike against our forces, we could be in great danger. The next that I've just recently added is cognitive electronic warfare. Electronic warfare has been on the battle space for a long time. You could actually say since World War I in many ways, because there was not only just jamming of some radio frequencies, but there was eavesdropping. But now we have the ability for artificial intelligence-enabled electronic warfare to do things in real time faster than any humans can. And this cognitive electronic warfare will be crucial for counter UAS operations and also to stop enemies' sensors and precision weaponry. However, it will also become a major target of the enemy. So a drone with fiber optic cable or with cable coming out of the back will aim directly at those kind of systems in order not to be jammed and to take them out. So we've got to think through the cognitive electronic warfare issue. The next one is visualizing the battle space. Commanders right now have a huge challenge in being able to see in multiple domains. And you can't do cross-domain maneuver unless you can visualize that domain. You have to be able to visualize the domains that matter. And maybe all the domains may matter. So how we do that is really important. Right now, we're still using two-dimensional maps for a lot of our coordination of operations. We have systems that show a lot on a screen, but unfortunately, those screens are usually big, bulky, and difficult to move around.
and we're not there yet. So we need to move to a what I call a Centaur Mission Command approach, where commanders have either a helmet or a visor, like a Apple Vision Pro or a HoloLens, that we're able to put all the information there that they need right in front of them without the screens. And we have to figure out how to do this in a system that I call distributed mission command, where the commanders operate without staff co-location, meaning you can't put all your brain power in one place, particularly under a tent, which is crazy. You can't use tents anymore for command and control. And if you put all of your brain power under a tent and all these computers out, you are a target that sticks out, you will be found, and you will be killed. And how will you replace all of those people? How will you replace? Our people are our most important asset. How you will replace the Corps G3 or the Battalion G3, S3, or all of those, you know, vital iron majors or the sergeants that make everything run, if they're all in one place under canvas getting killed. So we have to think that through dramatically. So visualizing the battle space is going to disrupt warfare tremendously, because if you can't do it, you're going to have a problem operating at the modern level. And the next is decision dominance. And that is, if you put all these things together, all of the other nine, you are then able to operate in such a way that you can hit the enemy 10, 20, 30 times, and it will be as if they're standing still. That's what we want to do. That's our goal, being able to accelerate our OODA loop to such a point, because we have the AI-assisted systems to do it, and we're putting the rest of these disruptors together to understand how to operate against an enemy so that we can make multiple strikes and they can't respond in time. We can respond in real time, and they're responding in the old way. So those are the disruptors.
Okay, I'm excited to talk through the imperatives and how that overlaps with your work. I do want to highlight why there should be an overlap. So in doctrine, we're told that the imperatives are informed by the operational environment and the characteristics of the most capable threats Army forces can encounter. And really, your work, sir, is looking at the current operational environment and the threats we may be encountering in the future. So let's start with the first imperative, which is see yourself, see the enemy, and understand the operational environment. For this imperative, the FM30 writers really focused on commanders' visualization, gaining situational awareness, and developing a common operational picture. I know you've touched on a little bit of this already, sir, but how does this mesh with your observations?
Yeah, the seeing the enemy, of course, is as old as warfare. But today we have new means of seeing the enemy that we have to integrate in real time. Imagine a layer from satellites from outer space all the way down to ground level. Outer space, then the stratosphere, then the whole airspace where we have aircraft and all sorts of other things flying, including drones, and then ground systems. All of these things are working to try to find the enemy. And now you can get satellite information from almost every country in the world, because most countries have satellites. During the Second Nagorno-Karabakh War of 2020, the Azerbaijanis had two Azersky satellites up, which they put up just prior to the war, and they were able to see the battle space because they were looking directly at their small area, their battle space, with those two satellites. Plus, they had access to all the Turkish satellites, and when they couldn't get stuff that they needed, they would purchase satellite time from commercial satellite companies. So satellites give you all sorts of information. For instance, ships in the ocean leave this long wake. It's like a string that follows behind them. Satellites see that and they see the ship. It's very difficult to hide. So we must understand that we have to embrace a concept called masking. And masking is more than hiding and more than camouflage. Masking is the full spectrum, multi-domain effort to deceive enemy sensors and disrupt enemy targeting. So what you want to do is deceive their sensors and do things to disrupt their targeting. Now, most people say, how can I deceive their sensors? Well, first of all, you must know what sensors the enemy has. Study the enemy, and you're better off than not studying them, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So
How many sensors do the Chinese have? Well, they have lots of sensors, but they only have so many types. They don't have an unlimited number. They may have 100 different types of sensors. They may only have 80 different types of sensors. We need to know what is in our area and what they use. What sensors are the Russians using? In other words, what electronic wavelengths are they working on? How are they working? Are they only, are they optical, thermal? Are they electromagnetic? Are they acoustic? Are they quantum? Those are the five areas we need to worry about. And they could be all of those things. So we need to be able to counter those. So we need to deceive the enemy sensors. And how can you deceive enemy sensors? Give me a simple way that an infantry platoon could deceive an enemy sensor.
So we use decoys in our operations all the time, routinely, as part of our battle drill of how to fight, right? We should, but a platoon doesn't set up decoys. They say they don't have any. A company doesn't set up decoys. They say, I don't have any decoys. Now, we've got to stop thinking like that. First of all, don't tell me what you can't do. Tell me what you can do. A platoon leader could carry with him or her, he could carry a whole bunch of decoys. Now, how could you do that? Well, targets at a rifle range look like a human being at certain ranges. You can set those off far to your left flank, far to your right flank. You can carry those. Some of them you can roll up. I mean, they're made out of, you can make them out of paper that won't dissolve, you know, laminated or something. The point is there's lots of ways. There's a smudge pot. You can take a can, put a little rock and sand in there and a little bit of burning material and some diesel and light it and set it up away from your target. And it will look like a thermal image. And someone will say, that's where they are. And they'll fire a weapon at it. You can deceive them with decoys. Other decoys that are very simple are like, on some of our weapons ranges, we have thermal targets, thermal blankets, they call them, that just you could hook up a couple of batteries to, and they give you a thermal signature. Because remember, we have to be able to hide mask in the optical, which is camouflage, in the thermal, which is blending in with your background, in the electromagnetic, which is not talking so much on the radio and reducing and communicating in ways that don't require electronic transmission. And in the acoustic, we have to lower our noise level because a lot of drones today will have acoustic sensors and they'll hear where you are and they will triangulate on the crack of the guns, for instance, if you're artillery or tank or mortars. They'll hear that and they'll be able to know where you are. So we've got to think through this whole masking thing. And then we've got to figure out ways to disrupt the enemy's targeting. Now, we can disrupt their targeting in many ways. We can jam their systems. We can use cyber attacks to make us look like we're everywhere. And they won't know what to kill. But there's other things we can do to disrupt their targeting. We can use smoke, multispectral smoke. We could be on the move so that we're constantly moving. It's harder to hit a moving target, even though precision weaponry can kill a moving target. It's harder to hit a moving target. So it's better to be moving than it is to be stationary. So these are some of the things that we can do, and masking is crucial to that.
And so I think what you're saying, there's an element of hiding out in the open, and there's also an element of looking like you're one of a thousand.
Exactly. It's both active and passive. And what happens is that it's, you know, for instance, we should be the best at passive camouflage in the world. Our vehicles should be camouflaged all the time. Our soldiers should be camouflaged all the time. Our systems should be camouflaged all the time. Do we do this? Not enough. We don't train it enough. You can't train it once a year and be good at it. It has to be something that's done all the time. And it has to be second nature. And once the destruction force from above you starts hitting you and pummels you into the ground and you lose people over and over and over again, everybody learns real fast. But we want to learn before that time.
Right.
We want to learn in training. And so we have got to be the best at camouflage in the world. So take away the optical spectrum as best you can, you know, from the enemy sensors. That's a great thing. So then the next thing is, okay, what about thermal? Well, we can't do anything with thermal. Not true. You can blend into your thermal background if you try. There are different ways. How many times have our forces in practice looked at their own forces in the thermal image and say, wow, we stick out like a sore thumb? How could we, in fact, reduce that image? And there's ways to reduce that image. You know, you can turn the vehicle off instead of having it run all night. That will make it cooler. You can tarp it in such a way so that it can't be seen very easily. That would be very valuable. You hide in forests, you hide in cities. there's places that will give you better protection and better masking. So we've got to change our mindset. For too long, we have been the Army, like in World War II, that had silver airplanes because we could. Now we need to understand that in a pure fight, the enemy is going to take every advantage and use that against us to kill us. So we have got to become much smarter, and we have got to be able to mask in these different areas. You know, we've got a mask in the optical, we've got a mask in the thermal, we've got a mask in the electromagnetic, which means we've got to stop talking so much on the radio, start using brevity codes, start using wire again. All of those things are possible. And some people tell me, I was just recently out at a striker brigade, you know, and they said, well, we don't have any wire. We got the wire, but we don't have any means to hook the wire up to talk. And I said, well, you got an intercom, right? So yeah, of course we got an intercom. Well, there's a little thing here. You can hook wires into it. You hook up the intercom from one vehicle to the other vehicle, and you can talk to each other, and there's no electronic transmission. Now, we could also go back to some of our old TA-1 and other kind of handheld wire devices. Wire isn't going to solve everything, but it will certainly lower your electronic transmission in an assembly area or in a defensive position. So the bottom line is we're not fighting people who have very low technology anymore. We're fighting people with very high technology, sometimes better than ours. And then we have to think about acoustic. We're much too loud. You know, if you're looking for the talk at night and they gave you a grid and they gave you the wrong grid and you're looking for it, what do you do to find it?
You listen to...
Yeah. You take off your helmet and you listen for the sound of the generators. And the generators are blaring away because we don't put them in the ground. We don't muffle them. And we have to have superpower, right? Maybe we shouldn't have so much power. Maybe we shouldn't have so many screens. So we've got to think through all that. And we have to be able to survive throughout all of this. All of this is very hard. So we've got to start thinking about this now.
The second imperative that I want to talk about on today's episode is account for being under constant observation and all forms of enemy contact. I think you've covered this a little bit with masking and a little bit with observation, it not being just visual, but observation within each domain. But I'd like to hear about your observations regarding unmanned aerial vehicles and drones too. So overall, what are your observations that you have made that listeners should know regarding this imperative?
Right. The unmanned aerial systems are the machine guns of the 21st century. If you wouldn't go to war with machine guns, you shouldn't go to war without small UAS. Unfortunately, we have very few small UAS in our units. We have the Black Hornet, which most people don't know how to use. I ask consistently soldiers if they've used the Black Hornet, and I get usually blank stares. There are some units in the Pacific, 101st and 82nd, that are using small UAS, probably hobby stuff, probably stuff that are blue UAS built in the U.S. But nonetheless, we need to start integrating small UAS like we integrated machine guns in World War I into our units. In most units, British Army, for instance, in 1914, British battalion had two machine guns per battalion. One was the primary, and the second was in a crate as a backup. So for the British Army in 1914, the machine gun truly didn't exist. They didn't plan to use it very much. By 1916, there were machine guns all over the place. And when the British Army launched its attack in July of 1916 at the Somme to German machine guns, they lost 60,000 casualties on the first day because they couldn't adapt from 1914 to 1916 their thinking in time. Now, we can't afford to take 60,000 casualties in one day. And most of those, 27,000 of those were dead. And most of them to machine guns. Some were killed to artillery and mines and other things, but mostly to machine guns. The machine gun changed World War I and World War II. In fact, the way we use machine guns is still not as successful as the way the German army in World War II used machine guns. They built their squad around the machine gun. We still do fire maneuver within squads. We've got to think through how we fight. But today, the small UAS is the machine gun of the 21st century. And if you look at what's going on in Ukraine, it is absolutely amazing. I mean, drones are killing as many people as machine guns did, for instance, in Somme. And let me give you an example of one guy. 25-year-old FPV pilot, first-person view pilot, Timothy Orell. He was with the 47th Mech Brigade of the Ukrainian Army. He was ordered the Order of the Golden Star with the title of Hero of Ukraine from January to May 2024. January to May, only that time period. During that time period, he eliminated 434 Russian soldiers, killed them. 346 were wounded by his attacks. 42 tanks were destroyed, 44 BMPs, 10 MTLBs, which are APCs, and 28 BTRs, which are APCs. One guy, FPV pilot. Can you imagine the kill ratio this guy has? We had anything like that for an Apache crew or a tank crew. Imagine how we would be exalting them. This is what FPVs have done, first-person view. And most of these, again, are very inexpensive compared to some of the systems we have. So we have got to start seeing modern war for what it is and integrating our combined arms operations in such a way that we use robots to make the first contact, that we have robots integrated to give us real-time information, that we have flying artillery and flying cavalry, basically, for every unit, every maneuver unit in the Army integrated into it. So we have got to think this all through and start adapting our training to it, because we're training so much still in the old way. We have a laboratory going on right now called the Russo-Ukrainian War, where we see everything. You know, everything I get is open source information. If you want to study that war, you can find everything out about it. I mean, for instance, we should have case studies right now going on in every unit in the Army. Air Mobile, you know, like the 101st and the 82nd should be talking about the Russian attack on Hostomel Airport, you know, when the invasion first started and how that failed and what would happen if you changed some parameters. That's the kind of wargaming they can do now. Look at what's going on in the Donbass or even in Kursk Oblast. And you can start saying, how are they using drones, integrating real-time information, getting the artillery to fire? How is the artillery shooting and scooting? How are they doing their distributed logistics in such a way that the Russians are having a hard time destroying their fuel and ammo depots, whereas our fuel and ammo depots are big and easy to find? And once we destroy all that, what are we going to do? You know, so logistics is a huge Achilles heel for us unless we start thinking differently. So distributed mission command and distributed logistics operations have got to be embraced, and we need people thinking and writing articles and doing war games and thought experiments on all of these things and not waiting for someone to give us the solution.
Just like writing new doctrine is a team effort, breaking doctrine takes a team. Without the crew and special doctrine division here at CAD, we wouldn't be able to bring you this show. Please don't forget to subscribe on YouTube, Apple, Audible, or Spotify podcasts, and follow us on social media at U.S. Army Doctrine to get updates on new podcasts, Doctrine Digest videos, and publications. Finally, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the official position of the United States Army, U.S. Army Training and Doctrine Command, or the Combined Arms Center. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Lisa Becker, and this has been Breaking Doctrine.